The last case of the morning is number 034266, Vendetta Jackson against the City of Chicago. Mr. Olson.
Good morning. It is still morning. May it please the court, counsel. This case arises out of a relatively simple and innocuous act. A Chicago police officer by the name of Vendetta Jackson applied for reinstatement to service with the department after coming off medical leave. After some fairly comprehensive discovery in the trial court, motions were filed, including the city's motion for summary judgment. The trial court found that, after reviewing all of the evidence, that it was abundantly clear that Officer Jackson was not a qualified individual. It was not found that she was a qualified individual with a disability because the trial court did, in fact, find that Officer Jackson had a condition which would be disabling.
Could I ask you whether you are contesting in any way either the existence of a department requirement that officers be able to carry firearms, or whether that's in some sense a bona fide job qualification?
Oh, absolutely not. The requirements of General Order 98.2 are quite clear and quite explicit as to what an officer must be able to do. Okay. What we are contesting is the summary judgment standard, whether there is sufficient evidence in the record to warrant a firm conclusion that Officer Jackson is not a qualified individual because
either
could not ambulate
without
a cane,
yeah,
or she could not safely use a firearm. A review of the record clearly shows that there is substantial evidence on one side of the issue and very little evidence on the other.
What do we do with her testimony before the retirement board? I mean, I appreciate the position that she must feel that she's in, you know, with the retirement board telling her, no, you're not disabled enough to have benefits, and the police department telling her, no, you're not undisabled enough, you're not well enough to work. But she does tell the retirement board that she can't reliably walk without spasms or without difficulty.
And that is testimony that occurred prior to the issuance of the decision of the retirement board. And the retirement board found that testimony not to be credible.
But that's what she said, though. I mean, you know, it's an odd way to create a conflict in the evidence to say, well, her position is she can't do it, but we're going to say that because she was found to be not credible, there's a genuine issue of material fact.
You've actually put your finger on the exact issue and the exact problem in this case. In your question to me, you said the city said that she was not able to return to work. That's not true, and that's at the heart of this case. The city didn't do anything. The city left her in limbo. They consciously refused to make a decision.
These letters, though, I mean, there's one letter that seemed very open-ended, saying, "Can you come back? If you can't come back to the police department, we'll help you out with jobs in other departments of the city," and on and on.
And there was also correspondence back saying, "Tell us where and when to show up, and we'll be there. And we want to do whatever needs to be done." She presented herself for duty. And one of the interesting parts about this case, which is different from other ADA cases, is that there is a system in place for responding to an officer that's coming off medical leave that is applying for reinstatement. There is a defined protocol as to what needs to be done, and it was not done. And that's where this case really, that's really where the birth or the inception of this case is. You can't, and one of the things that struck me so much about the trial court's opinion, to go back to it, he said he didn't understand what Butita and the cases in its progeny had to do with the price of tea in China. Well, the reality is it has everything to do with the price of tea in China because you're balancing equitable interests. You have two completely different organizations that have responsibilities for making determinations as to whether they can put a police officer on the street.
Well, I mean, But to focus, this is an ADA case, and the question really is there any issue of fact that needs to be tried on the question whether she is a, quote, qualified person with a disability? The trial court was willing to say, even though the evidentiary record seems scanty, that she had a disability within the meaning of the statute. So he focuses on the qualified part. And he finds, on the basis of the record as a whole, that she has not shown that she can meet those requirements of the general order.
He found that by ignoring substantial evidence to the contrary that's in the record. He ignored the opinion.
What's your best evidence to the contrary?
Dr. Bernard Bach's opinion released her to go back to work. Dr. David Demarest's opinion released her to go back to work. And the retirement board view released her to go back to work.
Do you know that they were focusing on carrying a firearm? I mean, I can imagine a doctor saying you're okay to work without focusing on particular job requirements, say, of a police officer.
The one presumption that needs to be made is that the doctor for the retirement board that has served the retirement board for 12 years has a clue as to what the requirements for a police officer are. We also have to assume that the body that is charged with making a determination as to whether an officer is fit or not has an idea as to what those requirements are. 98-2 has been around for a long time. If they say she can go back to work, she can carry a firearm. So that there's substantial evidence that she can carry a firearm. Plus, the most compelling evidence is the last time she was asked to qualify, she qualified. And during the reinstatement process, she was never asked to qualify. If she couldn't have qualified, she would have flunked on the spot. Nobody asked her. Nobody did anything. In order for the judge to get to where he got in this case, there were certain things that he had to do. He had to make some choices and some decisions. He had to weigh evidence, and the standard, of course, is you have to weigh it in the favor of the appellant or the complaining party, the non-moving party. This is something that on occasion after occasion after occasion, the trial court did not do. In fact, a complete examination of the record will show that in every instance that he had the opportunity, he weighed the evidence in favor of the moving party. For example, he said and relies heavily in his opinion on the fact that Officer Jackson never presented herself. That's not true. The record completely goes against that. He selected Dr. Dockman's testimony given 2 years after the fact as the one thing element that he could hold on to and ignored the testimony of doctors that had released her to work. So you have conflicting evidence in the record, Dr. Dockman on one side, Dr. Bach and Dr. Demarest on the other, over whether or not she is a qualified individual. Our judgment is that that raises a material question of fact, and it is seriously in dispute. The major problem with this case, one of the other major problems with this case is found in the testimony of Commander Bill Powers. What we tried to ascertain in the deposition was why did nobody communicate with Officer Jackson that they were not going to reinstate her? Because that communication, per Butita, would allow her to go back to the retirement board with a dispositive or a final decision that said, I am not physically qualified to return to work. As both of these cases, as Judge Cannelli said in a later case, you can't leave the person in limbo. All I need to know is, am I physically qualified? Please answer the question. In his deposition, Commander Powers candidly said, we knew she wasn't coming back to work in September of 2000. They knew that, and they never bothered to tell her. My time for now is up, unless the bench has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. We'll hear now from Ms. Wirth.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. May it please the Court. Under the Chicago Police Department's General Order 98-2, the validity of which is not in question here, all police officers, no matter what their assignment, are required to do two things. One, to be able to safely use a firearm, and two, to be able to maintain an independent, stable gait. At his deposition in this case, Ms. Jackson's own treating physician testified in no uncertain terms that she is not able to safely handle and carry a firearm. In her own deposition, Ms. Jackson testified that she uses a cane to walk, and it's undisputed that she believes that she could not take the treadmill test, the stress test, because she could not walk on the treadmill. On these facts, the district court properly granted summary judgment.
Now, opposing counsel indicated that there's some dispute with respect to the firearm, that in effect she never actually failed the test. What's your answer to that?
Your Honor, she was never at the point of failing or not failing the test. The undisputed evidence in the record is that she cannot carry a firearm. In fact, her physician testified that it would be police malpractice to allow her to carry a firearm, and she would pose a danger to herself and to society if she were allowed to do that. So there's nothing in the record whatsoever to refute her own physician's testimony, and she has not created a genuine issue.
Well, she says these other doctors are at least implicitly saying that she can. I mean, it's not unknown, of course, for doctors to come to different opinions about things. So I suppose the question is partly what's your response to that, but it's also partly you're implying that there's a sort of threshold qualification somebody needs to meet before you even let them take the firearm test. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if there's a threshold requirement before you allow them to take a firearm test, but if the person themselves are maintaining that they are not safe, and this is through her own physician's testimony, that they're not safe with a firearm, there's certainly no obligation for the city to say, no, we don't care if you're safe or not safe, we want you to go ahead and have a go at that firearm. So the question of her being able to carry the firearm is simply not, there's no evidence to refute her own physician's testimony.
So is it your position that the other doctors were simply not specific enough, that she needed to ask, say, Dr. Bach or Dr. Demarest, what about firearms?
Yes. I think nothing in Dr. Bach's or Dr. Demarest's evidence contradicts anything that her own physician, Dr. Dachman, testified to. There's absolutely nothing about her ability or non-ability to carry a firearm. They simply spoke with her to her ability to walk and examined her for her knee. There was never any examination, in fact, on her fibromyalgia, which is the reason Dr. Dachman says that she's unable to carry and use a firearm. This morning I will explain why Ms. Jackson is not a qualified individual with disability under the ADA or the Rehabilitation Act.
But could I ask you, I mean, toward the end of his argument, your opponent made a comment that if she'd ever really received a flat statement from the police department that she wasn't qualified anymore to be a police officer because of the fibromyalgia or what have you, because of the inability to carry a firearm, she could have gone back to the retirement board and pursued a claim there. Is that correct?
She could certainly have gone back to the retirement board, but she'd already done that. Well, I mean, no, that's not correct, to be specific. She had gone to the retirement board. The retirement board analyzed her situation under the Illinois Pension Code and found that under that statutory scheme, she was not she was not disabled. But that doesn't mean that she is a qualified individual under the ADA to be a police officer in the Chicago Police Force. The General Order 98-2 is quite unequivocal. It provides that all police officers, whatever their position, whether they're on limited duty or full duty, whether they're on desk jobs or sitting, roaming the streets, they're all required to be able to do these two things.
That raises questions to exactly what how the city views its obligation, assuming that the plaintiff here had gone had gotten in touch with you about alternates. What kind of alternates can the city offer a police officer who cannot perform these two functions? Apparently, even a limited duty officer has to perform them.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are no alternative positions there are no positions in the Chicago Police Department that would allow an individual to serve in the department who cannot, cannot perform these two functions.
So really, did she really fail to participate in the interactive process then, if it was going nowhere, was it not?
Well, she did, but even more importantly, she was not entitled to any statutory interactive process, because that only comes into play if the employee is a qualified individual to begin with.
What did you mean in this letter, then, where you said, if you know, maybe we send the accommodation papers for other jobs in the city? I can't find it right now, but...
Well, the city...
On page 16 of your brief. Finally, if Ms. Jackson contends that she's unable to perform any duties as a police officer but can perform some other vacant job for the city, please advise, and we will forward to her the city's reasonable accommodation request forms.
Yes, and which the city did. The record is clear that
the question is, what does the city view take the view that it does have an obligation to engage in an interactive process beyond the scope of police officer duties to look for another job within the city for her?
Your Honor, the other jobs, non-police officer jobs, I take it you mean civilian jobs, which would not, all police officer jobs require the two minimum to the requirements that we've been talking about. Civilian jobs do not, but civilian jobs are governed by their own collective bargaining agreements. And there's nothing in the law that requires the department to violate the collective bargaining agreement of these other jobs in order to accommodate her. That's not a
reason. But why did you put the sentence in the letter then? I mean, I think your Judge Ripple's question is getting at, is this a real offer, or is this just cosmetic? I mean, when they send the reasonable accommodation forms, is it just going to a dead end, or is the city actually pick up the ball and try to find, as it seems to say, other currently vacant positions?
Absolutely, it's a real offer to engage. I mean, the city, the department was obviously doing everything it could to see where she could be accommodated, and just because the department was doing that, of course, doesn't mean that it's legally bound to do that. The problem is that she didn't even come back to engage in that. She has never once said that she wants a job other than a police officer job, presumably because she knows that other clerical positions, civilian positions, pay much less, have different kinds of benefits. She's never come right out and said, I would consider working in another position. And of course, so even apart from the collective bargaining agreement problem, even she herself has not identified anything that she would be willing to take as a position other than a police officer position is all that she seems to want to have. Whereas the qualified individual with a disability is one who can perform all the essential functions of the job, and an employer's written description of what is required is, of course, evidence of what a police officer can do. And General Order 98-2 clearly sets that out. For all these reasons and the reasons stated in our brief, we respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Worth. Mr. Olson, you have 2 minutes.
A couple of brief responses. One of the concepts that has run through this case that is absolutely drives us batty is the idea that the officer can self-determine whether or not she is qualified for a particular job in the department. That's not the law in the state of Illinois. We cited the Toronto case. That's not the law under the collective bargaining agreement. That's not the law under police procedures. The responsibility of the department is to make a determination. There is a body of law in the ADA which talks about statements of an applicant as to whether or not they can perform a job and the relevance of that to a case. They are not applicable here. Here we have a case of an individual who has been qualified, has been on injury, and is coming back. She can't self-determine. What she thinks doesn't make a lot of difference, not underneath the regulations, not underneath the law, and not underneath the way that the case law in Illinois has been put forward as to what an applicant is required to know when they apply for disability benefits as to jobs that they can perform. I do refer you back to the Toronto case. Secondly, the issue of fibromyalgia. The city indicates that fibromyalgia was not an issue before the retirement board. Not true. Dr. Dockman made a statement. The fibromyalgia is referred to in at least four or five separate places in the record. When the police board made its determination that Vendetta Jackson was able to go back to work and discharge the police functions. Final item number three, the statutory scheme. The reality is there is a difference between ADA and the Pension Act. That's true. The argument, however, is unique because the entire city brief is based upon the requirements of the Pension Act and requirements of 98.2. Nobody focuses on what the ADA says. What they're focused on is what does the police department require? Red light's on. Anybody has a question? Otherwise, we go to lunch.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court is